Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 6, Dhyana Yoga, text number 47. Yoginam api sarvesham.
Yoginam api sarvesham.
Madgatendantaratmana. Sharavan bhajate yomam. Sameyuktatamo mataha. Yoginam. Of yogis. Api. Also. Sarvesham of all types of Madgatena abiding in me, always thinking of me. Antak Atmana within himself. Shradavan in full faith. Bhajate renders transcendent loving service. Ya, one who. Mam, unto me, the Supreme Lord. Sa, he. May, by me. Yukta, atama. The greatest yogi. Mataha is considered. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. And of all yogis, the one with great faith, who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendent loving service to me, he is the most intimately united with me in yoga, and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. Purport. This is a long purport, so of course we expect everyone to remember everything that's in the purport by listening very carefully to every word. And we'll test you. And if you don't pass the test, there's no prasadam tomorrow. What's that? Tuesday. The word bhajate is significant here. Bhajate has its root in the verb bhaj, which is used when there is need of service. The English word worship cannot be used in the same sense as bhaj. Worship means to adore or to show respect and honor to the worthy one. But service with love and faith is especially meant for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One can avoid worshipping a respectable man or a demigod and may be called discourteous. But one cannot avoid serving the Supreme Lord without being thoroughly condemned. Every living entity is part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and thus every living entity is intended to serve the Supreme Lord by his own constitution. Failing to do this, he falls down. The Bhagavatam 11.5.3 confirms this as follows. Yesham purusham sakshad atma prabhavam ishvaram na bhajantyavidya bhajananti stanat brashta patantyadaha. Anyone who does not render service and neglects his duty unto the primeval Lord, who is the source of all living entities, will certainly fall down from his constitutional position. In this verse, also the word bhajanti is used. Therefore, bhajanti is applicable to the Supreme Lord only, whereas the word worship can be applied to the demigods or to any other common living entity. The word abhajananti used in this verse of Srimad Bhagavatam is also found in the Bhagavad Gita. Abhajananti mamudha. Only the fools and rascals deride the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna. Such fools take it upon themselves to write commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita without an attitude of service to the Lord. Consequently, they cannot properly distinguish between the word bhajanti and the word worship. culmination of all kinds of yoga practice lies in bhakti yoga. All other yogas are but means to come to the point of bhakti in bhakti yoga. Yoga actually means bhakti yoga. All other yogas are progressions towards the destination of bhakti yoga. From the beginning of karma yoga to the end of bhakti yoga is a long way to self-realization. Karma yoga without fruit results is the beginning of this path. When karma yoga increases in knowledge and renunciation, the stage is called jnana yoga. When jnana yoga increases in meditation on the super soul by different physical processes and the mind is on him, it is called astanga yoga. And one surpasses the astanga yoga and comes to the point of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it is called bhakti yoga, the culmination. Actually, bhakti yoga is the ultimate goal, but to analyze bhakti yoga minutely, one has to understand these other yogas. The yogi who is progressive and is therefore on the true path of eternal good fortune. One who sticks to a particular point and does not make further progress is called by that particular name, karma yogi, jnana yogi, or dhyana yogi, raj yogi, hatha yogi, etc. If one is fortunate enough to come to the point of bhakti yoga, it is to be understood that he has surpassed all other yogas. Therefore, to become Krishna conscious is the highest stage of yoga, just as when we speak of Himalayan, we refer to the world's highest mountains, of which the highest peak, Mount Everest, is considered to be the culmination. It is by good fortune that one comes to Krishna consciousness on the path of bhakti yoga to become well situated according to the Vedic direction. The ideal yogi concentrates his attention on Krishna, who is called Shyamasundar, who is as beautifully colored as a cloud, whose lotus-like face is as effulgent as the sun, whose dress is brilliant with jewels, and his body is flower garland. Illuminating all sides is his gorgeous luster, which is called the Brahmajyoti. He incarnates in different forms as Rama, Narasimha, Varaha, and Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he descends like a human being as the son of Mother Yasoda, and he is known as Krishna, Govinda, and Vasudeva. He is the perfect child, husband, friend, and master, and he is full with all opulences and transcendental qualities. One remains fully conscious of these features of the Lord, he is called the highest yogi. The stage of highest perfection yoga can be obtained only by bhakti yoga, as is confirmed in all Vedic literature. Yasya deve para bhaktir tata deve tata guru tasyaite katita yad katasyaite kahita yadartaha prakashante mahatmanaha. Only unto those great souls who have implicit faith in both the Lord and the spiritual master are all the imports of the Vedic knowledge automatically revealed. Bhaktir asya bhajanam tad iha mutra padadi nairasye na mushmin manakalpanam etad eva naishkaramyam. Bhakti means devotional service to the Lord, which is free from desire for material profit, either in this life or in the next. To avoid of such inclinations, one should fully absorb the mind in the Supreme. That is the purpose of Naishkarmya. These are some of the means for performance of bhakti or Krishna consciousness, the highest perfectional stage of the yoga system. This is in the Bhaktivedanta purport to the sixth chapter of the Srimad Bhagavad Gita, the matter of dhyana yoga. Yoginam api sarvesham madgate nantaratmanaha bhajate charavan bhajate yomam same yuktatamo mataha. And of all yogis, the one with great faith who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, is most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. Most people, especially nowadays, will find it quite surprising that bhakti yoga is the highest form of all yoga. generally people identify yoga with exercise. Just like Atma means the body, Atma means the mind, Atma means the soul, depending upon what you're referring to. So similarly, people in the bodily concept of life, which means practically everyone, they would imagine that if they can advance the means to get your leg further around towards your other ear, when you put it behind your neck, the farther you go, the further you advance. And if you can stand on one, two hands, that's very good. But if you really want to get to the pinnacle of success, you have to learn how to stand on one finger. And those who can stand amongst those who can stand on one finger, those who can stand on that little finger, they're the best. And some are trying to stand on a fingernail. They're getting closer to the absolute. Or if you pay, at one time if you paid $5,000, you could take a course and learn how to levitate. Because they never levitated, all they could do is bounce. You had to have a pillow underneath you when you landed. They would actually bounce. I can't do it. I never paid the $5,000. So this idea that love, bhakti, service. Well, if you say love, people will appreciate. All right, love, that's all right. But service, my God, what is service? Where are they serving? McDonald's or what is... What kind of service? I'm doing service. I'm a waiter. Because sometimes people actually join a yoga society and they do what's called karma yoga. They'll wash the dishes. But the object of love and attention, Krishna, that's not very clear to most people. Just like nowadays, at least in America, maybe in parts of Europe also, they have kirtan yoga. What do they call that? Kirtan yoga? Something like that. They have these bhajans. And many, many people come to them. But they're chanting all these mantras, including, mantras to Krishna, Hare Krishna, and they chant Om Shivaya Namaha and Durga Dema, or whatever they chant. They're chanting so many things. They just like to sing. They don't know what they're singing. They just like to sing together. It's mostly because people need community. And nowadays there is no community. The only time they ever experience community is they go to the football team. And half the people are divided in half. Half are wishing that the other half goes to hell. That's not, in one sense, you're with your friends and your dearmost enemies. And it becomes so, and there's so much animosity that after one football game, soccer game, in Central America, after one team lost, as they usually do, then they started a war. Two countries started a war against each other. So obviously the atmosphere is not completely harmonious. But we actually want some harmony, that we actually have some mutual interest. And when people sing together, they can actually feel that. And of course, even the songs of the demigods have some potency behind it. Nowadays, people don't consider themselves to be religious. Some people do, but it's not so popular to be religious. I don't know here in Slovenia. If you go to church on Sunday, they have church services on Sunday. Many people go. No. Do they have, what's that?
Much less than before.
Mostly old people. Do they have church choirs still?
Yes.
Still singing. Some people like to go there. They like, especially the music. Of course, they're singing. What kind of style do they sing in? Like 18th century style. So, yeah. Young people don't like that so much.
Bach.
What's that?
Bach.
On
Wednesday, I met the Sankirtan lady, young lady, who is singing in a choir, and on Wednesday, students have big masks like these Afro-Americans dancing. And
oh, they have that, yeah.
They have that, and it's quite heavily popular. Many students come, Christians. And here are nice Christians I met in Sankirtan. Young people are very smart and nice, and they gather there and sing. So it's quite alive.
Yeah, even the Jewish community does that. They have kirtan and they get up and they dance. And it's become very popular. I mean, they have some religions are very, you know, they think the 18th century was spiritual. And others are more trying to become a little bit more modern. They can see, you know, the devotees are dancing and they get people get a reaction to it. Like in the black communities in America, they really get into it. In the Baptist churches especially, you know, they get up and they start dancing in the aisles and hallelujah, hallelujah, praise the Lord. And they're shouting out. And they get really carried away. They start speaking in tongues, Slovenian, Croatian, all kinds of languages. So, people actually they want community because we originally come from one community.
Called Krishna's community.
People are missing that. Matter of fact, the whole material world is actually people just feeling separation from Krishna, but they don't know it. And therefore, they're going around and they think everything is Krishna except for Krishna. They think an ordinary man is God, and they think God is an ordinary man. But here it says that worship is natural. Everyone is worshiping. The question is what they're going to worship. And therefore, in the beginning, there's karma yoga, dutiful activity, so that people can not be so much anxiety when they're working. Because generally speaking, people are working, and they're always looking forward to something else. They're always looking forward to the results. People are working during the week, and they're always looking forward to the weekend. And after the weekend is over, they're so burnt out, they're looking forward to going back to work again. So everyone is always like the ass running after the carrot. Everyone's just running after something, but they never really get it. So karma yoga means to try and calm the mind down so that we do things simply for the sake of doing it. When I was in New Brajamandala in Spain, as I mentioned before, there was a group that came there. 20 people, because in New Brajamandala it's a nice, very nice place. Fresh air and nice place to walk. And so people come there for retreats. And one group came there for retreat, and the whole retreat was about mindfulness. The distance between where their accommodations are in the temple is maybe 10 yards or something. But they take an hour or two to walk from where they are to the temple, because every step they do very mindfully. They're concentrating on the step. Which seems a little crazy to most people, but actually they realize my mind is so uncontrolled, I'm so agitated by mind, that if I just think of my foot moving in space, it actually pacifies my mind a little bit. It takes my mind off of the fact that I hit my wife over the head with a vase yesterday. They become a little pacified. So this mindfulness is what karma yoga is, except that they after they get to the wherever they're going, then they become even more agitated because it's all kind of useless. But at least karma yoga, they have some idea that there is some higher purpose of life. In other words, instead of getting the fruit of result, they're actually looking forward to something, either heavenly planets, emerging in Brahman, or something. There's some fruit, but it's not the immediate fruit. They're doing duty because they understand if they do their duty, they're going to get something higher. Exactly what it is, what the value is, they sometimes don't know. But they have faith. And that faith comes, generally speaking, because there's Brahmins in the society. When there's Brahmins in society who've been trained up from their childhood to chant the mantras, the Vedic mantras. For instance, sometimes in the Gurukul they take 6 months to learn how to chant one letter in the alphabet, like an ah. Did I pronounce that right? I only took a month, so I don't know. Every letter of the alphabet, if chanted perfectly, actually has power to it. So the Brahmins would spend years as celibate students in the ashram of the guru, going through great austerity, like Krishna and Sudama, going to the woods and collecting wood, firewood, and living as a menial servant to the house of the guru in great austerity, just so they could concentrate the minds on learning to chant the Vedic mantras. First of all, the alphabet, the intonation, and there's so many different things. And when they did that, when they chanted the mantras, they could control the entire universe. For instance, when the priests at the sacrifice of Prithu Maharaj wanted to throw Indra into the fire sacrifice because he was kept on stealing the horse of sacrifice. Therefore, they chanted the mantras, and Indra himself, the king of heaven, was falling into the fire. That's how powerful the Brahmins were. Even the Kshatriyas, they could chant a mantra and they could produce a weapon that could destroy the universe. Now, if we chanted something, we cursed someone or something, they just laugh. There's no potency. But when Sringi, a 5-year-old, how old is he? 10 years old or something, boy, Brahmin boy, cursed the emperor of the whole world, and not just this little planet, but he was the emperor, I imagine, of a much greater area than just little Bardvarsha. Then the king was going to die in 10 days because of the curse of Sringi. So that's power. And when people went to the Brahmin priests and asked for a benediction, you know, they wanted a wife, or they wanted some wealth, they wanted to get cure from a disease, then the priests would chant some mantra, give them benediction, and they get what they wanted, what they desired. And as it became more elaborate, like the kings, they performed big elaborate sacrifices, Agnihotra, Ashwamedha sacrifice, Gomedha, whatever. They actually get the result. And eventually they actually go to, so because they got a result, therefore they develop faith in the Vedic literature. Without actually getting something practical, no one will develop any faith. Even Krishna told that to Nanda Maharaj. He said that if people, you have to know what the result's going to be. Because if you don't know what the result is, when you perform the activity, you don't know if you got the result or not of the activity. So you should know what the result is. So why are you performing the sacrifice? What are you trying to achieve? You should know the result. So the Vedic literature has a description of so many possible results from so many different sacrifices. And if you learn how to perform the sacrifice perfectly, chant the mantras perfectly, you get the result. From simply getting some health all the way up to mystic power, you can control the universe. So therefore people perform karma yoga because they had faith in the Vedic literature that you're actually going to be able to go to the heavenly planets, emerge in Brahman, or some elevation. And people did get elevated. And they go from karma yoga to jnana yoga. Once they realized, they heard about heavenly planets, and maybe they went there or whatever, came back and realized it wasn't what they were looking for. Then you get interested in jnana yoga, which is the aim of realizing oneself as Brahman, getting free from all material entanglement. And eventually they'd actually realize Brahman, and if they were fortunate and had good association, they come to this Ashtanga yoga process and meditate on the super soul, become ecstatic, and by good association, they understand that there are Vaikuntha planets and that there's Goloka Vrindavan, and they further go on to performing devotional service, and they realize that bhakti was the highest form of devotional service. Indeed, in India, previously, people didn't consider this yoga system, what the Westerners consider, of Ashtanga yoga very important. One of my teachers in Ashtanga yoga, his name is B.K.S. Iyengar. I don't know if you ever heard of him. I even went and studied at his institute for some time. And his history was that he was the student, he was actually the son-in-law, of one yogi named Krishna Namacharya, who was a Vaishnava. He's actually a devotee. Spent the last part of his life chanting japa. He was a worshiper of Narayan as a Sri Vaishnava. So he had many students, but he had to make a living. 18th century England, make a living as a Brahmin was not so easy. Brahmins had to do something. They couldn't chant mantras and have any effect. So they had to do something. So he had to make a living by becoming not only a teacher of one Raj, I believe in Mysore. He was teaching his children. They were generally teachers, but they didn't teach the Vedas or anything. But in order to teach them, he was also teaching them physical exercise. Now these physical exercises actually came from Europe. They were most of them were calisthenics coming from the YMCA in Europe. And also from the contortionists in Sweden at that time. But if you told the king, I'm teaching you calisthenics from YMCA and contortionism from Sweden, it wouldn't be very impressive to the Raj. So you had to give it Sanskrit names. Make it kind of like mystical. I'm almost there. My leg is almost there. I can see the Lord almost.
He's appearing in my heart.
So Krishnamacharya had his son-in-law. Iyengar was actually very sick when he was a child. Because things, the sanitation, everything else. Anyhow, he was a sickly child. But somehow or another, his father died, his mother died, so he was left being taken care of by his sister. And so Krishnamacharya tried to engage him in helping with the family business, which was to teach essentially the Raja's children and others doing a show of yoga, this Hatha Yoga. So he taught B.K.S. Iyengar his yoga, but he wasn't a very good student, and so he hurt himself most of the time. One time he tried to do these splits with your legs on both sides, and he wasn't ready for it, and he split his groin. It took a month, 6 months or something to recover. So, at the end, B.K.S. Iyengar decided to go to open up a studio in Mumbai, actually in Pune. But no one took it seriously. No one thought this yoga system. was actually any value. People were just lifting weights. They thought, this has a value. This yoga system is, you know, has no value. This so-called yoga system of all these exercises has no value. So he couldn't get any students. He couldn't make any money. So he was living on, a lot of the times he's just living with his family on water because he couldn't make any money whatsoever. It wasn't until one famous violinist, Yehudi Menuhin, came and he met him and he was sick and he taught him some of these yoga exercises and cured him, and therefore he developed a name for himself in the Western world. And then he came to the Western world, and the Western people are really into the bodily concept of life, and they thought this was something spiritual, and it became popular. But otherwise, in India, they thought this was a waste of time. If you want to do exercise, you might as well just lift weight or go to a gym or something. But the idea of this finding enlightenment through hatha yoga, they thought it was ridiculous. Which in one sense, it is ridiculous. Because the standard yoga text, which is the Patanjali's yoga system, the Yoga Sutras, as I mentioned before, only has one verse about asana, that it should be sthira and sukha. It should be steady or firm, and it should be comfortable. That's it. There's no standing on your head or whatever else. Of course, probably one time he was walking in a park with Ramaswara Prabhu and others, devotees, and he saw someone doing a headstand in the park. And Prabhupada said, "Is that one of our men?" And Ramaswara Prabhu said, no, Prabhupada, we don't do anything like that. So Prabhupada said, well, actually, it's not so bad. He said, there are so many asanas, Shirshasan, Sarvangasan. They're quite healthy. And then he came back to the car, and Ramaswara, who used to do hatha yoga when he was a devotee in the shower when no one was looking at him. He do all his asanas in the shower, or supposedly in the shower. He ran up to Prabhupada and said, Prabhupada, he said, could we do that? He said, none. Prabhupada said, not necessary. But Prabhupada wasn't against exercise. But that's what it is, it's exercise. One time, Nanda Kumar, he was doing some exercises. And Prabhupada called him and he said, what are you doing? He was acting as Prabhupada's servant. He said, I'm doing some exercise, Prabhupada. Prabhupada said, oh, that's pretty good. Keeps the body healthy. And one time one devotee asked Prabhupada, he said, is it all right if I do exercise? And Prabhupada got down on the floor and he was doing push-ups.
Yeah, this is good.
So Prabhupada wasn't against exercise because otherwise he knew that his disciples just eat and sleep. So a little exercise is all. But we shouldn't think it's the path back to Godhead. But there is a path, of which even Ashtanga Yoga is part of it. But that's after many years of other kinds of activities, yama, niyama, cultivating, becoming a civilized person, and then something about asana, whatever. But the aim is to meditate on the supersoul. And Krishna says it takes many, many lifetimes. And there's restrictions. You have to go to a secluded place. You have to lay deer skin on the ground and cover it with a soft cloth. Well, actually, first you put the soft cloth, kusha grass, then the soft cloth, then the deer skin, then you sit on it. And you have to be devoid of sex desire, which I don't think most of the hatha yoga students are teaching. Matter of fact, if you read their books, the modern yogis, even
Krishnamacharya's
son, when he wrote his commentary on the Patanjali Yoga Sutras, when they explain what Ishvara Padan is, worship of the Lord, and when they explain what Brahmacharya is, because these are the principles also in the yoga system, under yama and niyama, they explain in such a way as to accommodate the Westerners. They don't say you join the Hare Krishnas and you shave your head and you live, the men are on this side and the women are on this side. They wouldn't appreciate that very much. So what is this? This is from the 18th century. I could have joined the church for this. Anyhow, I'll stop there. Think of any questions? Yes.
When we perform fire sacrifices, obviously the mantras are all wrong. So,
well, you get warm if it's cold. It's pretty cold.
What is the idea behind it? Like,
what's the idea?
There's a show. Benefit from the mantras derived. So,
well, there's, if we're chanting
the Shingadai mantra or other
spiritual mantras, there's some benefit from chanting the names of the Supreme Lord. But throwing grains in the sacrifice, and there's no real benefit. I mean, in itself, the fire sacrifice, what does it produce? At the end, you walk outside, and the demigods are pouring things down on you. What happens?
So it's basically just so we can engage in some activity when we worship the Lord.
Well, yeah, that's basically it. There's no real spiritual benefit from doing the sacrifice. Prabhupada said it's just a show. Of course, when we're doing initiation, there's some purpose. We have the deities open, the Vaishnavas are there, Agni's there in the form of fire, and people making a vow before the Vaishnavas, before the demigods, before the deities, before the fire. That's the idea. To make a vow. Otherwise, Narada Muni, when he saw Dhruva Maharaj, he didn't say, "All right, Dhruva Maharaj, what's your name?" "Dhruva? You're Dhruva Ananda Das now. Let's, is it, you got any firewood in this forest around you?" "Swaha. Your name is now Dhruva Das." Chant, Om Namo Bhagavate 1600 times a day. No, it wasn't there. It wasn't necessary. But we ourselves, we don't take anything seriously. What to speak of a fire sacrifice, marriage, anything we don't take seriously. You make any vow, cross your fingers and forget it the next day. What was that vow I took? Oh, it doesn't matter. So the idea is to make it something that would impress the mind. You promise. But even people promise before the fire, they don't take that seriously. Therefore, Prabhupada expected people to come up to a certain standard before he gave them initiation, that the fire sacrifice wasn't necessary. It wasn't the vow, because it was taken before the fire sacrifice. It's like when you get married. The idea is not that at the time of marriage in the Western world, then you get to know the lady, find out if you're compatible. And even the Veda culture, when they got married when they were sometimes 8 years old, 10 years old, and they got to know each other gradually. And there was a culture that actually fortified the relationship. So nowadays marriage is expected that it should last at least 6 months because they know each other. If they actually get married. As I said before, one devotee lady was living with another devotee man for 20-something years. And they had 3 children. And one day the lady, the Mataji, went to her mother and said, "We decided to get married." And her mother took her hand and said, "Are you sure he's the right man?" So that's modern culture. So we need something like a fire sacrifice, something to impress our minds. Something that little social pressure that we actually made a commitment. Otherwise, people are very whimsically this age. And the devotee should actually be practicing for some time and should be serious. Prabhupada said in the beginning he gave initiation simply, you know, because he needed some help, practically speaking. Then for the first initiation, devotees didn't know very much. Matter of fact, they didn't even know the four regular principles. The next day after the initiation, then he put the four regular principles on there. Guess what? Here's what you're supposed to do. Whereas Malati Devi Das, he said, when he did initiation in San Francisco, Prabhupada said, after the initiation, he said, bow down. Because they didn't even know they were supposed to bow down. And the devotees thought, Prabhupada said, blow into the fire. So they're So after the ceremony was over, they were all blowing into the fire. So that was at the beginning, Prabhupada did, because he needed some men and women to help him. So after the first initiation, people showed up for the initiation. They asked them, do you want to get initiated? Sure, why not? So they sat down at the initiation for the first time there, and the devotees never saw the person again. Later on, of course, Prabhupada made it more strict. And then fire sacrifice was so that there was some idea that they're doing something important right now. Anything else? Yes.
Hare Krishna.
In our kirtan programs, kirtan waves, holy name, even sometimes I think on Sunday feast we have some different instruments, different styles of music. So for a public program, do you think it's a good idea to experiment with some different styles of music that would be attractive for more people, or that would...
Well, as long as the mantra is proper, that's all right. The mantra, as long as you don't change the mantra, you can change the tune and things like that, or even musical instruments when it's appropriate. When you're dealing with devotees, it's not generally so appropriate. It distracts from the mantra. You get a whole orchestra and band and things like that. It's not necessary for the devotees. But for the non-devotees, then it may be helpful, the style of music. Anything else? Yes.
Maharaj, in this lecture, you were mentioning that we should know what the result is, so to measure the effect, I mean the productivity of the activity. So, but in the morning lecture, the whole lecture was more or less about results being, at least ultimately, results being inconceivable to us. So I was once chanting, and I was
crying. The final result is inconceivable.
What?
The final result.
Yeah, that. But that's
there's other
the
results.
Only thing what interests us, actually.
Really?
I mean...
You wouldn't like to be a little ecstatic once in a while?
Yeah, but...
little gaining awareness and realizations along the way. Yeah, well, that's... It's not that you go from zero to, you know, infinite all at once. It's a gradual process of gaining relief, as it says in the first two qualities of pure devotional service, and sadhana bhakti, or klesha agni and subhadra. So you get all, you gradually get good qualities, you become attracted.
Well, klesha agni is interrupted quite frequently. This. I mean,
klesha agni.
Yeah, in my case, kleshas. I feel kleshas.
We get, but gradually become purified of the kleshas. Gradually, as our avidya goes away, as we become conscious of Krishna, then all the different stages of sinful reaction go away too. papam, parabdha, parabdha karma, kuta, they gradually disappear also as the vidya goes away. No, it's gradually. If you look back when before you became a devotee, what you were doing before you were a devotee, and what you're doing now, is it any different? Yeah, so there's the result. Thank you very much. Grantaraya Srimad Bhagavad Gita Kidai.